which takes place in January, February. The archive has done our bit as part of the program there. We've run a series of walks around various parts of Melbourne. We started off with a walk in the city, going along St Kilda Road and up Collins Street, for reasons that will become obvious as I go through the talk. We've done another one around the theatre district of Melbourne. We did one up in Carlton, and we've now done two walks in St Kilda. We try and do a different walk every year because it's something we do once a year and we want to get people around. So we figure if we run them every, you know, do the same walk every 3 or 4 years, we'll probably, you know, we won't bore anybody too much. So the St Kilda walk has been very popular. We did it in 2005, we've done it again this year. And this afternoon's talk is based very much on that walk. So, Graham, did you want to actually talk about the law? We'll start off the talk with a bit of an introduction to the legal aspects. One of the things with doing gay history is, or gay and lesbian history, is that because it's a subculture or a culture that's been usually criminalised throughout history, you're actually doing history, if you like, from underneath, so to speak. So the main society has always been very forbidding, or you know, they've tried to legalise, criminalise the subculture out of existence. And this means that you don't have access to the same sorts of primary documents that you would have if you were doing other sorts of history. So we're looking at things like court reports, at tabloid newspaper articles, at oral history transcripts, but there's not a lot out there, particularly if you go back more than about 50 or 60 years, written from the point of view of gay and lesbian people. It's information that's written from the dominant culture about gay and lesbian people. So if you were to read a court report of someone who was perhaps arrested for indecent behaviour, you're only hearing one side of the story. And what we've had to do is actually read between the lines to work out what's going on. That's one of the interesting and exciting things of that sorts of history that we do. Graham will give you a bit of a rundown on the legal background, the historical legal background, just to put you in a bit of a context. Then I'll run through the Melbourne context, and we'll get into the thinking stuff after that. Graham.
Yes, and it's because of the reason why that history got so famous, of course, is that people have been living it, been concealing and for good reasons. Homosexuality until quite recently was illegal, and of course has been considered a sin by the major Judaism, Christianity, Islam, those kind of Middle Eastern religions, have always considered it a sin. Those two things came together. I guess one of the dangers with doing history is it becomes started at a certain point and then it has its own history, and then that has its own history, and next thing you know you're back to 1533, which is kind of where this starts, because the laws against what was called sodomy or buggery in the British world begin with Henry VIII, not perhaps the most obvious defender of, you know, kind of virtue in the family, notorious heterosexual serial wife killer, and yet at some point it pops into his head that the problem with Britain was that they didn't have tough enough laws on sodomy. And so in 1533 they are introduced. And he wasn't alone in this, this was a kind of West European phenomenon. The burning of the sodomites, for example, is I think a Dutch reference. Henry VIII decides that it's a problem, introduces laws against it, and the penalty is death. And from time to time, over the next several hundred years, it is in fact, people are in fact executed for engaging, men are executed for engaging in same-sex behaviour. The laws, as I say, are kind of enforced only sort of spasmodically, but it's pretty bad to get caught up in it. By the 19th century, things are starting to settle down a bit, but the death penalty is dropped, and you know, comes down to 10 years hard labour. But while they're doing that, the number of offences are actually expanded. So initially you kind of had to be caught in the act in order to be successfully prosecuted. In the 19th century they reduced the penalties, but they increased the number of acts. So propositioning somebody starts to become an offence. You know, just hanging around in public, chatting somebody up itself becomes an offence that you can be locked up for. British lawyers, of course, arrive in Australia when the British arrive in 1788. By about the 1850s, Australians kind of have self-government, so they're able to bring in their own laws. But generally, they follow the British. So as the British sort of reduce the penalties, eventually the Australian colonies do too. As they expand the number of offences, the Australian colonies do too. So very similar in the way that history plays itself out. This of course makes it, this is part of the reason why it's so difficult to get the history. People are of course not trumpeting the fact that they're engaging in homosexual behaviour or in fact they are interested in it. That's an offence. It's also of course, as I say, a sin in the eyes of the church, and this of course leads people not just to be afraid of being public but also to feel bad about themselves. It's one thing for the law to say you're a criminal, but quite another for sort of authorities or religious authorities to say actually you're a sinner. Or a bad person in and of yourself. This then gets reinforced in the 19th century by the rise of a kind of medical model that says, look, really the problem isn't that it's a sin, you know, we don't have to believe that necessarily, but if it's an illness, which is not exactly a huge leap forward in terms of how people are going to feel about themselves. And so really, until very recently, into the 1970s, it was illegal in Victoria for men to have sex with each other, or as I say, to proposition each other, until 1981. The churches start to change their attitudes beginning in the 60s and 70s, but even now we see them having problems with, you know, same-sex clergy, homosexual clergy and so on. The medical profession starts to change its attitude also in the 60s and 70s, mostly under the impact of gay people standing up for themselves and asserting that actually we don't accept this, we don't believe this, and if you think we're criminals or sinners or mentally ill, it's up to you to try to prove that. And eventually those start to crumble. But there is a kind of long history there for people concealing their sexuality and feeling bad about it themselves. And that's very much the reason why we get the kind of fragmentary evidence that we're forced to rely on for this stuff. And so really well into the 1970s when people do start to speak for themselves.
Right, so that brings us to Melbourne particularly, and Melbourne's gay history, of which St Kilda is part of it. We've got evidence dating back to the 1850s, 1870s of same-sex behaviour, same-sex relationships happening in Melbourne, of meeting places that people would meet each other, and of organisations that people would belong to. And the reason why we started our first walk in the central city area was because that's where initially a lot of the camp or gay meeting places were. Collins Street there on the left hand side was the site of a lot of coffee shops in the 1920s, 1930s that were colonised by camp people. In the days of 6 o'clock closing, when all the pubs shut at 6 p.m, you didn't really have a bar culture like there is today. So what you had instead was coffee shops. People would have their own regular coffee shops. You know, you'd go to the pictures and then afterwards you'd go for a coffee or a cup of tea and a slice of raisin toast seems to be the sort of main menu at most of these places. But Collins Street there was one of the main places where a lot of these coffee shops and also hotels, even though the pubs were shutting at 6 o'clock, there were pubs that people would go to, that men particularly would go to meet their friends, and social groups would actually evolve. Groups of friends would go to the same pub, and then they'd organise, you know, their own parties and stuff to go on to after the pub's finished. The city bars up there at the top, again, another place that men, gay men, meet each other at the city bars or at other bars and so forth around the place. Lots to be said for, you know, men in swimmers and actually the city bars in 1908 when they were opened, men not in swimmers because they were segregated bars, men's and ladies, and the men didn't have to wear swimmers. So of course it's a magnet for gay men.
And down the bottom right there, the Menzies Hotel Bar in the 1960s. This was about the time when 6 o'clock closing finished up, 1966, and opening hours of hotels were extended. Now, the Menzies had a reputation of being a fairly respectable place that you could go. It was a nice upmarket sort of venue, carpets on the floors and so forth, not your typical lino and tiles gear kit that you'd have during the 6 o'clock school period. And it was a nice, quiet, respectable place to go, and you know, you'd be likely to meet other men who were like you. And so it was the sort of place that that was popular. Now, St Kilda particularly has a very long gay history, and dating back, as far as we can tell, into the 1880s. Now, why is St Kilda one of Melbourne's gay, or can, as the phrase was up until the 1960s? Why was St Kilda one of Melbourne's camp suburbs? Well, it's a place from after the tram arrived in the 1880s, it became a popular seaside resort, as you'd know. It was a place where people came for their holidays. In the days before, you know, long distance travel and airlines and so forth, if you couldn't go away on a big trip for a holiday, you'd go somewhere fairly local. And St Kilda offered you all of the amenities of a seaside resort very close to Melbourne. You could get to it by tram, even. So it's got a lot of people on holidays, a lot of people from other places here on holidays. They don't know anybody here, and more importantly, nobody here knows them. They don't have the sort of family at home looking over them. They don't have the neighbours at home watching what they're up to. So people are here for a good time, and they can be anonymous while they're here. It has a lot of leisure activities for people to enjoy, and they're also a way of meeting people. You've got, as you say, the Esplanade, where people promenade. You can walk up and down the Esplanade and get into conversation with complete strangers, because it's a more relaxed place than you know, maybe Preston or Coburg or somewhere like that, or even, you know, Rochester or, you know, Bendigo. It is a relaxed place. The other thing that makes St Kilda popular, it has a bohemian atmosphere. Now, particularly after the 1930s and during the war, etc., and into the 1950s and 60s, it's got a population which has come from other places. It's also got a population it's got a seedy element to it. There's a criminal element. People here living in flats don't necessarily want to know what their neighbours are up to, and they don't usually care what their neighbours are doing anyway. So you've got that anonymous lifestyle. And one of the things, so that sort of character of St Kilda builds towards it becoming a place where people who don't necessarily fit in somewhere else will come. And one of the things that helps in the first instance are flats. We mentioned in our walk, as we're taking people around St Kilda, you know, flats are incredibly important in St Kilda becoming a camp suburb, but also in just the development of a gay lifestyle anyway. Before the first flats were developed, around the time of the First World War, you lived at home with mum and dad until you got married. And if you're not the marrying kind, you're in trouble. You go and live in a boarding house. But of course, boarding house keepers, who are always ladies, usually act as sort of, you know, in loco parentis, you know, that sort of they're like your mother, and they want to know who's coming into their house, and there's rules about no visitors in the bedrooms after such and such an hour, and it's a fairly rigid lifestyle. So the development of flats in the around World War I into the 20s and 30s gives people the chance to live their lives in a way that they've not been able to live their lives beforehand. And this catches on very quickly. If you're not the marrying kind, and you don't fancy living at home with mum and dad, and you don't like the idea of going to a boarding house, you can actually get yourself a flat. Your neighbours, as I said, don't necessarily want to know what you're up to, because they've got lives of their own. you have an anonymous urban lifestyle. And this is obvious from even as early as 1921. Truth newspaper. Now, thank goodness for Truth newspaper, I say, because if you're doing gay history, Truth newspaper is one of the Bibles. They printed all the stuff. They wanted to sell newspapers, obviously, and they figured the best way of doing this was to print the juicy gossip that the respectable newspapers wouldn't touch. So, of course, they send reporters to the divorce courts and sit there and take down all the gory details. Page 2 of the Truth was always called Doings in Divorce. It was a full page of divorce evidence, who did what and who said what and why. But in 1921, Truth had an article about the pestilence of perverts, I think. They always went in for alliterative headlines. And it said in 1921, Melbourne's flatland is infested with these people. And they'd actually sent a reporter along, obviously in deep disguise, to a pansy party, as they described it. And he sat there, sipping drinks and doing cross-stitch and needlework with the pansy, in a flat somewhere in Melbourne's flatland. So right from 1921 onwards, or from that period onwards, flat are seen not just by gay people as being a way of being able to live their lives, but it's also seen by the wider society as that's the sort of thing that goes on in flats. And various areas like St Kilda, like the Park Street, South Yarra area, where there are lots of flats, develop a reputation as being, you know, pansy paradises. Until by the 1950s, all Truth has to say is that John Smith, 26, of Park Street, South Yarra, whereupon, in just to describe him like that, everybody reading Truth would think, aha, I know what type of person he is. So flats really start to develop things. In the 1950s, we've got reminiscences of people who would go to parties in St Kilda, in flats. There was an actor by the name of Ivor Freeman, who used to host regular Friday night soirees at his flat. He used to wear a long Asian-style dressing gown, silk kimono sort of thing, very mulcowered, and serve very cheap wine, apparently a chaterne, a kind of dessert wine, just to anybody who would turn up. And he'd read poetry to the guests. So it was very, very decadent, very, very indeed. Okay.
So one of the key issues for camp people prior to the 1970s is finding each other and finding a space where they can be with each other and be a bit more open and flamboyant than otherwise. We often think about homosexual life before the 70s in terms of the closet, of people not hiding, concealing themselves. And more with researchers and scholars starting to think, well, that's true, but it's only half the story. The other half is the ways in which people find others. Nobody actually lives, or a few people actually live, this completely isolated lifestyle that we imagine the closet, the image of the closet coming up with you alone in a dark space. People do, in fact, find ways. And we're now starting to talk about the idea of a kind of dual lives, of having two kinds of lives. One where you're completely concealed, you know, probably from your family, certainly from your workmates. You don't talk about your father's life, or you just make up the girlfriend or the boyfriend to, you know, kind of throw them off the track. But there's this other life, this other stream in your life where you found other people like you. You're looking for a boyfriend, or you're looking for a girlfriend, or you're just looking for a party and a social occasion, a chance to meet people, to relax, not to have to become on edge all the time about accidentally using the wrong pronoun. And obviously, the development of flats is important. You know, you've got a private space, you can have private parties, you can have dinner parties. If you happen to have a house of your own or a bigger flat, then you can have something a bit bigger, a bit rowdier. You still have to be careful. But one of the other things, one of the other strategies that people adopt is the idea of creating a space for yourself within the broader community where it's a bit more accepting and a bit more open and a bit more tolerant. And this idea of bohemia this kind of idea that there are people who live in a very respectable city like Melbourne. There are people who don't really fit in, who don't conform to that level of respectability. And they are people who work in the theatre, for example, which is an extremely kind of disreputable occupation. It includes people who are politically on the fringes, you know, the Communist Party, people like that, who weren't necessarily open on these questions, but who accepted that there were differences and we kind of had to gather together. And so you get the way in which you can start to meet people and you can start to relax a bit and find others a bit more like you. And one of the places where we actually find camp men and camp women sort of being able to express themselves is in these kind of fringe events. In particular the art schools, which develop in Melbourne, they're essentially fundraising events for the arts community. And they're often very big events, they might hire the St Kilda Town Hall or the Palais, and they'll be, you know, there'll be big parties, you'll pay to attend, there'll be raffles and things going on there, and they're very often fancy dress parties. So you might just dress very, very formally. It's an opportunity to dress up in your tuxedo or your best ball gown. But there's also a kind of fancy dress element, and people would go to these events in fancy dress. Now, one of the things about fancy dress is it gives you the opportunity to dress outlandishly, for men to dress as women, for example, or for women to dress as men. And these are, and they're often judged. You know, a way of encouraging people to come in fancy dress is that there's a competition. And the best group, the individual, will win. And so we have descriptions of these fancy dress balls, the art balls and so on, people coming in fancy dress and really competing very hard. Probably the most prominent group that kept winning from the prize year after year of these things was a group headed up by Fred Asmussen. And Fred was the chief window dresser at Myers. Very flamboyant, as people would have said at the time. And not entirely committed to concealing his flamboyance. He designed Myers floats for Moomba, for example. Those of us of a certain generation may well remember what they looked like and how impressive they were. He would stage events for Dame Merlin Meyer. He had a very extravagant event when she was having a house party. She asked Freddie to kind of do the day call for her. It's said that in Myers, he kind of, his office was this kind of vast space full of stuff that he would use to decorate the windows. Gold chandeliers and statues and things stopped filling up his office. But he also organised his boys, they called them Freddie's boys, the boys who worked in, the young men, who worked in Myers as window dressers. And he at camp were very inclined to bring camp men into to his employment. And they developed a kind of group identity. They would think of themselves as Freddie Boys. So Freddie Boys, they'd compete with the people from David Jones, or, you know, from whoever the other, you know, big department stores were. And every year they would get themselves together to go to the art schools in full costumes. And year after year they would win because Fred had all, he had the flamboyance, he had the costumes, he had the resources to make this happen. And as I say, years after year after year, they would win. This group, however, is a different group. This is a social group of men called the Boilers, who, beginning in the late 50s, started to gather together. And they would go to various pubs in Melbourne. They'd get there on Friday night after work, once a month. Then they started having social events at members' houses. And then they started getting themselves together to compete, to go to the art schools and to compete. And in this particular year, when you ask people, there are people we've interviewed who are kind of in the photos and gave us these photos, what the musician is meant to be, there is no answer to it. It's just flamboyant, it's frantic, it's not meant to be anything in particular. It was a huge relief, really, because you felt like it must be meant to represent something. The reason why this is one of their favourite photos is this the year the Boilers won. They beat Freddie and the boys and Myers. This is one of their sort of great trophy moments that they're celebrating. But it's important for people that they can dress up, and it's not exactly being open, they can, at least to be having fun and to be able to break out of the routine. But people felt so solid, they're always on edge, always feeling like they have to be careful. And, you know, maybe just a few nights a year for some event like the art balls or something similar, they can just come cut loose for a little while and have that acknowledged and valorized.
Now, it was great to see.
Task force give people a chance to dress up. And they were renowned from the 1930s onwards, according to Truth, as being, Truth would report on the art balls. 1925, it was decadence and sin by the sea, because it was held at the Palais that year, and it was sin by the sea. And Truth complained that the whole thing was getting out of hand. Well, obviously the organisers took note, because in 1927 it was described as the dance of dullness. So you can't win with Truth. But they did take note of a propensity for a number of young men to dress in the clothes of the opposite sex. And there was, in the 1920s and 30s, a group of drags, as they were known. Max Du Barry here was one of the younger of them. He appeared, this is the outfit he wore to the art ball in 1952, and the next day got his paper, his picture on the front page of The Truth. Now, Max was a very flamboyant drag queen. He was only young in 1952, probably, I think, about 18 or so?
About 24.
About 24. Quite young, very flamboyant, very, very out there, and was known as a character around Melbourne at the time. Now, I think we've recently discovered that in 1969, I think it was, a film called The Naked Bunyip was made, which was an investigation of all things sort of steamy in Australia. And the producer was hunting around looking for a homosexual to interview. We need a homosexual. Just one will do as a representative. And who do they find? But Max, living in St Kilda at the time. Now, he died a few years later on. He was still quite young when he died. But he's actually been captured on celluloid in 1969. We've got to find a copy of that. We're hunting for one there. But he's interviewed in that. So, from the art balls, you get these quite outrageous characters. And there were drag identities around St Kilda in the 1940s, 50s, 60s. Max was one. Another went by the name of Box Hill Annie. Now, we're assuming she lived out in Box Hill, but would actually come into St Kilda to play. So, Box Hill Annie, there are stories actually of one night in the early 1950s, Box Hill Annie was walking down the street, Grey Street. And usually the drags were actually quite friendly with the working girls, on first name terms usually. And Box Hill Annie was walking down the street, Grey Street, very late one night in the early 1950s, with a male friend who was dressed as a man. And the police car cruised by them very slowly. And the guy who was walking with Box Hill Annie got very nervous, because of course you do get nervous about policemen, or you did then. You get nervous about policemen. And then suddenly he heard one cop say to the other, "Oh, okay, he's with Box Hill Annie," and off they drove. So she was obviously known to the police. I'm quite friendly to them, no doubt. Another St Kilda character was a drag who went by the name of Zazu Pitts. Now, Zazu Pitts was a B-lister Hollywood film star in the 1930s. She had a very expressive face and big, wide eyes, and she could sort of munch to the camera quite nicely. She, was always the best friend in a lot of films. Anyway, this drag went by the name of Zazu Pitts. Now, there's an interesting story here. This is 1950. His real name was Harry Lloyd Francis, and he lived in Barclay Street in Kilda. And very early, it says there on the morning of the 25th of November, someone saw Zazu on the bridge, dressed as Zazu, standing on Queen's Bridge, talking to a man. Suddenly there was a splash, and somebody fell into the water. Well, the next thing we know, Zazu is actually dragged in by the police and forced to identify the body of this man who's actually fallen into the Yarra. Was he pushed? Did he jump? No one knew. Now, drags being what they are, they love a good story, and you don't let the truth stand in the way of a good story. So it went the rounds of the coffee shops and the cafes over the next couple of days that when Zazu was confronted with this body on the slab, he said, "Yes, I did throw a body into the Yarra, but it wasn't that body." So he was actually, he got off, there was no case to answer, so quite lucky there. But the idea in at that time, in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, about drag was that a good drag could actually pass as a woman. If you could actually walk up Collins Street at 2 o'clock in the afternoon and nobody figured that you were actually a man wearing a frock, you were considered a very good drag queen. Later on, drag actually got more into the sort of burlesque humour and sort of taking the mickey and so forth. But in the 30s and 40s, it was all about, could you get away with it? And if you got away with it, you were considered a high practitioner of the art, so to speak. Now, as I said, the drags were actually quite friendly with the working girls, which brings us to another aspect of Canada.
So you've got this group of people who are criminals, sinners, psychologically deranged, not surprisingly the places within society where they find others who are prepared to accept them and tolerate them also tend to be one of the worst. This development of a kind of fringe in society, or an underworld, or a bohemia, where people who don't fit in, who aren't approved of, can relax with others who, if not quite like them, are at least held in the same kind of general contempt. And of course, St Kilda has long had and quite this old reputation for, amongst other things, a place where sex is available, commercial sex is available. And the kind of stories that Wayne was telling about Boxer Lenny coming into town, being known to the police and therefore being somewhat safe for one reason or another from harassment. Clearly this kind of bohemian world exists really intensively in Sydney in the 30s, 40s and 50s. And of course, you know, has come and gone since, as I don't need to tell you, a source of controversy and debate. There are parts of St Kilda where male sex workers are kind of known to hang out historically and in the present, reflecting that kind of greater openness or more space where people can engage in this kind of behaviour that society as a whole doesn't approve of but doesn't seem to be able to exist without. And this is an image that we prepared for Gay Community Outrage magazine. Damien wasn't in fact a sex worker, he was just the other young good-looking person we knew who was breaking up on night and staged the photo. But you can think about the way, this year is in fact the 50th anniversary of the beginning of law reform debate, homosexual law reform debate. It starts in Britain in 1957 when a government committee called the Wolfenden Report, named after its chairman, had been charged with investigating the laws on homosexuality and prostitution. So you can see really nicely there the way in which the authorities position these two things together. And if they're going to investigate the laws, they do both at the same time. The report is released in 57, and because, you know, everybody, Britain was the centre of the world for lots of Australians, Canadians, New Zealanders, and this was widely reported that the committee was set up, that it was reported. It recommended changes in the laws on prostitution and on homosexuality, recommending that in relation to homosexuality, the consenting adults in private should be allowed to do what they like. And this slogan of the consenting adults in private really takes off and provides the basis for decriminalisation. It takes the British 10 years to do it, you know, between 57 and 67. It's a huge debate. It's something that people here pay attention to and it's reported in the mainstream press. But it's interesting that there's this association between prostitution and homosexuality. And it's one that endures, and it's partly, as I say, it's something that people themselves choose to pursue, to kind of find other people who are, you know, outside the mainstream, but it's something that the authorities impose as well. More recently, in the last 20, 30, 40 years, that separation, those two groups have kind of separated out, there's now a kind of respectability that's available to homosexual people that's still not available to sex workers. You think, for example, if you did a kind of Google search through the age, the way in which Shakespeare Grove gets positioned as sort of seedy, dangerous, undesirable, compared to Commercial Road and the creation of sort of the gay scene there. Those two worlds that were really closely intertwined in the 50s have been separated out, and I think it's a striking fact that the gay community has established itself as a kind of respectable, acceptable face of Bohemia, and others have been left behind and have been less successful for doing that. One of the places where camp people can find each other on a regular basis is in the theatrical world. Theatre, as I say, is a kind of not tremendously respectable occupation until quite recently. And it was also so a fair kind of place that harbored difference and let people who were already necessarily, since you want to be an actor, you're already a bit kind of worn out, aren't you? So you're going to be open to that kind of behaviour. And the little theatres in particular, the mainstream theatres of course are well known for having, you know, lots of famous gay characters in them. You think about people like Frank Green and Bunny Brook and so on, who often make their way out in television, but they're also established actors and actresses at the time. But the little theatres are really important too, and that's where St Kilda's been important historically. Dotted around little theatres where people can just sort of meet other people and maybe explore interesting questions. With the rise of the gay movement after the late 60s, the theatre becomes tremendously important. It's a way where homosexuality can be expressed and debated and discussed in a kind of, in a creative and literary sort of way. So beginning in the late 60s, there was a lot of gay politics that was talking about that. But it often also expressing itself in creative, artistic ways. The small theatre, Folk Theatre Works, for example, which has long had, seen the gay theatre during midsummer and during the kind of other festivals. So it's a place where people could find each other, get settled, and just kind of relax and express themselves a bit.
Now, I mentioned earlier about the Melbourne bars. Now, this is your place.
Yes, I'm attributed to that.
We've seen it before. And what a fantastic image, because it sums up a lot of what St Kilda was about for camp men, particularly, at the time. The whole area, like the whole of Melbourne, the whole area was studded with sites, locations, where gay men would meet other gay men. Now, sometimes for sex, often for sex, but often in a world where there's no commercial scene, where there's no gay newspapers like there are today, where there's no gay radio station like there is today, often the only point of contact you've got to start with is in those places that gay men have actually colonised as their own. Now, when people talk about beats, they usually think of toilet blocks, but it can be a park, it can be a length of street, it can be a piece of the beach or whatever. And often, people would actually meet, men would meet other men there, they'd get to recognise the regulars, they would get to talk to the other regulars, and they would be invited to private parties and become part of the friendship social groups that were around Melbourne in the 30s, 40s and 50s. The sea bars at St Kilda, for obvious reasons, were one of those meeting places and had been for quite some time. There are reports, I know as far back as 1915 in The Troop, there's a case where two men were, an army sergeant and his younger boyfriend were caught at the St Kilda bars. And the boy got off, or the younger man, who was about 18, got off with a very heavy fine. The older bloke, because he was actually an army sergeant, was flogged and then received hard labour. So St Kilda Baths has a very long gay history. One of the most interesting characters ever at St Kilda Baths was not a gay man, but a very interesting woman called Harriet Elphinstone Dick. Now, Harriet here on the left was a native of Brighton in England and emigrated to Australia in the 1870s. She was a champion swimmer and used to teach swimming at Hegarty's Baths here in St Kilda and won competitions as well. Now, interestingly with Harriet, She probably never knew or called herself a lesbian. But she emigrated to Australia with her friend, Miss Alice Moon. They set up Melbourne's first women's gymnasium, picture here on the left, from 1882, which was in the Queen Victoria buildings where the city square is now. And they ran that up until Harriet died in 1902. They had a house down at Brighton. Harriet was involved with the swimming pool, the baths here in St Kilda. They also had a farm out in the bush at Clayton. Now, the interesting thing, and I got this actually from John Cooper's History of St Kilda, the interesting thing about Harriet and Alice's farm at Clayton is they allowed no male animals on their farm at all. It's a complete feminist separatist farm in the 1870s, 1880s. Now, the other thing, interesting local St Kilda thing with Harriet and Alice, is that in the 1890s they got involved in spiritualism, seances and so forth. They had a spirit leader called Pat, who told them that if they sank an oil well at the end of the Red Bluff in Elwood, they'd strike it rich. So they did. They wasted Lord knows how much money drilling for oil at the end of Elwood Beach there. Didn't find a thing. So the spirits obviously lied. But Harriet is a very interesting character from the early days of St Kilda. And interestingly enough, both of these photographs are actually from the State Library collection. The portrait of Harriet is actually the one that she gave to Alice, or one of ones that she gave to Alice, and it's written on the back of it in her own handwriting, to Alice, with much love from Harriet. So it's a very touching little memento. Now, another interesting woman identity in St Kilda was Val.
Val was part of the theatrical world. She lived in the city, was involved in theatre, and had, of course, lots of theatrical friends, gay friends. She herself was a lesbian. At one point, it came into her mind that what Melbourne really needed was, again, this is the city opposite where the town hall is, a coffee shop that was open to Bohemians and all of that involved. It's worth remembering, coffee shops are quite sophisticated in their day, and when we take it for granted now, you go and sit somewhere and have a cup of coffee. This was a bit racy in the 50s. And so then she set up her coffee shop opposite the town hall, and it certainly attracted, it was open late because it wasn't licensed, so they therefore could stay open late. And people would come there and relax, have a cup of coffee. It was a pretty impressive place by all accounts.
Is this in
Kilda Town? No, sorry, this is Melbourne Town.
Thank you.
Very impressive kind of place, wicker chairs and purple carpets and a piano in the corner and live music. And it was so successful that eventually she kind of decided she wanted to do it again. And then she did come down to St Kilda, down near the junction there, called Cafe 31. Totally named because it was at number 31. Val, the coffee shops are important. Again, they're a place where you can go, you can relax, you can have a good time. If the proprietor, as in this case, is interested in having your kind of people in there, then it is a place where you can meet others like you. And again, this is a very broad category of people like us. It includes the theatricals, it includes people who don't quite fit in, or often a criminal element there, members of fringe, fringe political organisations, that's essentially the Communist Party in the 50s and 60s. People could mingle quite comfortably in those kind of places. And there were, in fact, several of them scattered around St Kilda, as you'd expect, this was a place of St Kilda as a Bohemian place. So something called the Old Men's Coffee Shop.
Old Boys.
Old Boys. Not far from where Bowles was. And again, we've got from oral history, we have no idea if this place existed until somebody told us about it and mentioned in detail, they told us where it was. They would go there on Sunday afternoons. It was a place where, you could have kind of sit and relax and meet other people. It was, you forget how important that is for people. But they're also places of danger in some way, precisely because they're public, because, word spreads that this is a place where we are accepted. So there was another one called El Sombrero, which we know about because we had the ASIO report on it. ASIO sent a report to the military saying that there was a problem with El Sombrero, that lots of servicemen, women in the military, were gathering there. And it was also a place where lesbians gathered and where criminals gathered. And therefore, though, this was a one-page doc, it was recommending that the military police not keep an eye on this. Because it's a fear of it's a security risk. This is the 1950s, the Cold War's in full rage, the communists, the homosexuals are kind of undermining the nation, and places like Sombrero is exactly where it happens. Yeah?
Again, where was that?
Sombrero was up in the air.
Wellington?
Wellington Street, in St Kilda.
On the north side, about 100 metres from the junction.
We're still tracking down the address.
Yes.
Not somebody who remembers vaguely where it was.
I just want to get clear what's Melbourne and what's St Kilda.
Yeah, it's St Kilda now. Because it was this kind of scattering of cafes, restaurants where people would be accepted and so on. El Sombrero, as I say, was targeted by ASIO, was watched by them, and we know this because the documents are now available. Interestingly, we also have a report from somebody who used to go to El Sombrero, so it's not, and this is a nice example where we're not relying on the police or ASIO. Jan Hillier, who will be coming to later, went to El Sombrero. She remembers vividly that there were in fact lots of service women there, and that they couldn't afford to be caught there. And so people like Jan, who was very out, very comfortable with her sexuality and had nothing to lose, people like Jan would sit in the window seat. So they keep an eye on who was coming in. Men coming in with short hair, the word would go. And the girls who were at risk would be out the back door and out the back gate and on their way before the kind of men with short hair came in. So it's a nice example of the way in which these places are both places of refuge, but also places of danger, but also I think places where you build up a sense of community, where you start to look after each other, and they're important. And that's kind of why they stick in people's minds, I think. You know, when we're being interviewed when we're in our 80s and 90s, about coffee shops we went to, we're probably not going to remember them with the same intensity as people who remember those, because they were important in people's lives. We took to Jan Hillier, so no coincidence at all. Jan's a bit out of focus.
It's a very poor shot, but
that's okay.
The other one. He's a much younger Jan.
Yes. This is Jan on the left, with her girlfriend at the time, and Maloon at Luna Park, a site which is a site that pictures back in the 20s.
I remember the moon.
Yeah. Jan was born in Adelaide, came from Melbourne. That's good. Clearly a butch. There's no concealing who she is and what she is. She gets around like this all the time. At one point, in the kind of early 60s, she's into the gay scene. She would go to the cafes and the bars and places where people like her were accepted. This is like traditional people. Potential girlfriends and so on. She would hang around El Sombrero, look after people. She decided at one point in the early 60s to have a birthday, for the birthday party. And the way you kind of did that then, unless you happened to own a big house, which most people didn't, you would hire the local scout hall or a local hall, and you'd get a license for professional men, a liquor license. And Jan did this and went down to Maisie's, which was in
Tuakura.
And basically this was a very kind of camp crazy pub. Spread the word that she was having this party and everyone should come. Several hundred people showed up at her party. And Jan, having a little entrepreneurial mindset, decided, well, this is all very well. We'll use these events to make some money. And so she started to organise monthly events. Now, you couldn't go to the same place every month and say, hello, I'm having a birthday again. So she started moving around town. She would have like 12 birthdays a year in different parts of the city and hope that nobody would kind of put two and two together. And in the days before electronic databases, they probably didn't very often. There were a couple of times when the cops turned up, when she was on the other side of the river one day, the cops turned up and said that she and her tribe should get back to this side of the river.
And she did on frequent occasions, but she wasn't about to be intimidated by the likes of them, because she knew her legal rights and she was prepared to stand up for them. But having established this idea that there was a market, what we now call a market for gay parties, she started to organise them on a fairly regular basis. She then went on to become a prominent kind of entrepreneurial figure, establishing a series of events over the years in different parts of Melbourne, some of which we'll be coming back to a bit later. And then in the 1960s, things started to change. The kind of life we've been describing, you can see the way we kind of reason this here, 40s, 50s, 60s, and all. But the kind of life that people lived in the 20s and 30s wasn't dramatically different from, you know, after the war. But looking back, we can see changes happening. In the late 1960s, though, things started to shift. Society was shifting. Things were becoming more, change was starting to happen. And one of the ways and one of the places where that happened was in the camp communities that were developing. You know, the fact that a lot of people were prepared to turn up to janitor parties is an indicator in retrospect. The people were a bit more confident, a bit more prepared to be out. Overseas, it was even more the case. In the United States, beginning in the late 40s and into the 50s and 60s, gay people were organising themselves politically into organisations. The Mattachine Society, Builders of the Lycus, not very out, who knew what these names meant, but places that where people could gather and were interested in lobbying and educating people. A number of Melbourne women living in St Kilda were subscribers to the Daughters of the Lycus magazine, which was published in the United States, but circulated by word of mouth, and you could subscribe and it would be posted to you. As it happens, in the kind of late 60s, two or three of them happened to write, accidentally in a sense, to Daughters of the Lycus and said, actually sorry, one woman wrote to them and said, I think I'm the only one in Melbourne, you know, this is just and they thought, no, that's not true, we've got a mailing list here. They were a bit suspicious about the letter because it came from a place called St Kilda, which is not a very odd name for a place, they thought. But after they checked their mailing list, they discovered there were other lesbians in St Kilda, and they put them in touch with each other. They wrote, do you know you're not the only one in Melbourne? St Kilda. They put these women together. And they decided that they would form a branch of the Daughters of the Lycus here in Melbourne. And they held their first meetings in somebody's lounge room, which was the only real option for them, down in Carlisle Street in 1969. The organisation lasted for two or three years and went through various kind of transformations. But Daughters of the Lycus is clearly, or unambiguously, the first organisation for homosexual people that are interested in politics and campaigning around politics. There have been these social groups like the Boilers and they've been green costumes and winning prizes and so on. But Daughters of the Lycus, it's a social group, it's a place for women to gather. They also go public. They get interviewed by newspapers. They start to go onto the radio. They're interested in educating the public. And as I say, they have their beginnings down in Carmichael Street.
And I presume that group of women create the letter.
The letter is, this is in fact the American magazine that they subscribe to. They don't in fact have a new plan for a Romeo newsletter of their own, of which we've got a few copies, but they never really got themselves. A very small group.
It was the mailing list for the ladder that actually was responsible for kickstarting their organisation. Now, of course, while politics was going on in the late 60s, the Melbourne, the camp commercial scene, as we call it, kicks off as well. In the 1960s, once the 6 o'clock closing is finished, various pubs started to find, now that they were open until 10 o'clock every night, started to find that some nights of the week were more quiet than others, and they were looking at ways of making money. And so some of them would actually run a camp night or a gay night once a week. You'd have to know pretty much which pub was doing what night of the week. Because if it's Tuesday, we've got to go here, and if it's Wednesday, we've got to go there. But in the into the 70s, that was very much the case into the 70s. But in the 70s, various entrepreneurs out there. Jan was running her parties around St Kilda at the time and her venues. But various entrepreneurs out there in the 70s started thinking, okay, what if we had a venue, a bar that was gay all the time, not just one night of the week, but every night of the week. And in St Kilda, one of the first to actually open up was Mandate, which was on the corner of Barclay Street and Carlisle Street. And it opened in the late 70s. It was gay-owned, staffed by gay people, and it was a gay place. A lot of money was spent on setting up this bar, and they would actually spend money on a regular basis to actually revamp the decoration. One of the popular motifs that I can remember, it closed down in, I think, 1989. I went just in the dying days of it, and it was a jail motif. Corrugated iron walls and lots of bars everywhere. Not very cosy at all, but it was, at its time, it was a new thing in Melbourne. Now, other pubs around St Kilda had a gay history, and one of the most important was the Prince of Wales.
The Prince of Wales, as you know from your own local history, has a long history of its own, as a watering hole, a place where people could gather, and has, in Richard Peterson's history, we can see that they've had a kind of camp history as well as the broader history that embodies it. In fact, he's just working on a radio documentary at the moment looking at Prince of Wales around the bands that used to play down, how important that was in terms of the Melbourne music scene, but also about this event on Sunday night called Pokies, which was a Sunday night drag show organised by Doug Lucas, seen here, not passing very convincingly as a woman. This has become a theatrical drag that we now, I think, are looking at the drag of, as opposed to the passing drag that Wayne was talking about earlier. Doug Lucas and Jan Hellier, who together put together the idea of Pokies and set out to make it happen. Sunday night, of course, it was, it's not like there was a lot of competition in Melbourne on Sunday night, but it was the place to be. Everybody went there. The performances were really, it was kind of very elaborate production. The costumes were very expensive and well made. The choreography was rehearsed. There were kind of big dance numbers of three or four drag queens, three or four dancing boys. It was probably not the thing I remember most. They weren't taking shirts off, it might have been the appeal. But the costumes and the performance is what people were most struck by. It was really a kind of a very memorable moment. It lasted for a very long time, for about 10 years or so, every Sunday night. The shows would change every 6 weeks or so. If it wasn't really working, it might be more frequent. But essentially, these were kind of big production numbers that were put together in order to last a long time. One of the other side of the Prince of Wales, sort of across the stairwell, there was a piano bar. So on one hand you've got the kind of Doug and the drag queens performing, on the other hand you can sit around and have a little sing-along if you want to. One of the most famous nights of the bar was in 1986, when Monty Punchin celebrated her 104th birthday, having recently come out as a lesbian, and been widely hailed as the world's oldest lesbian. Nobody else claimed the title at the time, so and here we see Deborah Legay, one of the drag queens from the other side of Pokies, Monty in the middle there, and one of the Pokies guys. Clearly at a kind of moment in a really interesting woman, and somebody worth a proper biography. She's in fact written her own work, dead now, as you imagine, being before in 1986. But we have scrapbooks that she kept, there's an interview with her where she talks about her life as a lesbian beginning in the 1920s when she has her first girlfriend and so on. A really significant moment figure. And Pokies provides the kind of place where someone like her can go and eventually come out.
Wasn't the big thing about her the fact that she lived as a man for many years and was unknown to be a woman?
No, I must be thinking of somebody else. She wasn't just a woman.
There are a number of people who fit that description, but certainly not one.
Edward DeLacy Evans, Bill Edwards, Marion Edwards. There's a big tradition of women passing as men. And that pretty much brings us up to the present day. St Kilda is still a very gay-friendly suburb, and this is sort of illustrated by the fact that it's a key location for the Midsummer Festival that happens, or for a lot of events that happen at the Midsummer Festival every January, February. One of them, one of the most important being Pride March in Fitzroy Street. Now, this was the first Pride March was held in the mid-1990s, and at the time, up until that time, Melbourne sort of hadn't done any big street marches or anything, because the Mardi Gras in Sydney, everyone always considered, had done it before and done it bigger and better than we ever could, so we won't. But the organisers of Midsummer decided that they a good way of showing the wider community what the gay community was all about was to actually basically put us on display, if you like, in Fitzroy Street. The organisers got in touch with all the various organisations. You know, that by the mid-90s they were thinking, well, hang on, there's a couple of newspapers, there's all of those pubs and clubs and bars and cafes and restaurants that are gay-owned. There are organisations like the Gay and Lesbian Archives. There's PFLAG, Parents and Friends of Gay. There's all sorts of organisations. They got in touch with them and said, would you like to be in the march? And the response was absolutely overwhelming. So now, 15 years or nearly 15 years on, it's a regular fixture in Melbourne's gay calendar every January, February. So as we show people, as we go around on our walks, St Kilda does have a very long and very interesting and diverse gay history, starting way back in the 1880s with Harriet Elphinstone Dick at the swimming pool, and moving right through to today. It's an ongoing part of the St Kilda community. I'd like to thank you very much this afternoon for inviting us along, and I'd like to call on Graham Carberry, who's the past president of the Archives, just to give you a bit of a rundown on who we are and what we do. Graham, would you like to?
Thanks, Mark.